Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Progress toward equity for Black Americans has been shaky, and after decades of a widening wealth gap, the pandemic led to mass closures of Black-owned businesses. Black women were disproportionately impacted, and the unemployment rate for Black Americans took much longer to recover than that of white Americans. And in the wake of George Floyd's murder, as the U.S. began recognizing Juneteenth as a federal holiday, the forces pushing for equality grew louder. Banks, money managers, and their clients throughout corporate America looked to start playing a greater role in closing deep disparities related to race, promising to hire more Black Americans, pay more equal wages, and expand opportunities. Now, 2 years later, how have they done? Over the next hour, we'll try to answer that question in this Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak. Progress toward the goal of racial equity has been choppy at best. Most data disclosed from large firms across corporate America and the Federal Reserve are from 2020. Until that year, Federal Reserve data show the disparity between Black and white Americans only deepened in terms of household net worth. For John Rogers, the founder of Ariel Investments, who's on the board of major Fortune 500 companies, the challenge ahead is important to soak in. While things have started to change in corporate America, the progress is now widely seen as terribly slow.
The data is crystal clear. Things are getting worse when it comes to the Black wealth gap. Ray Bashar from the Federal Reserve in St. Louis has data that shows between 1992 and 2016, college-educated Blacks saw their wealth decline 10%, and college-educated whites saw their wealth increase over 90%. This idea that things are getting better, I just think it's so important to pound home that it really is not getting better. I think that these companies are more committed, but we've got to remind them that they've got to do more than just the token small efforts. They've got to just have more of a systematic understanding of how to create true diversity and true wealth in minority communities. We got a few little bright spots, but we need to do much more.
John Rogers points out that for most large firms, their staff don't look like the communities they serve. Charles Phillips, the co-chair of the Black Economic Alliance, explains part of the problem.
Building wealth is something the Black community has been struggling with for decades. And average household now is about 10% of a white household. So that's obviously kind of the definition of the problem. A lot of that comes down to home ownership, the fact that mortgages weren't as available, incomes weren't as high, redlining, lots of issues. So the home ownership issue is around 41% for Black people, about 71% for the nation. And so closing that gap is at least one path to increasing Black wealth. But there are other issues as well.
Phillips was former president at Oracle, who left and ran software giant Infor. He's been working with firms across corporate America to hire or promote 1 million Black Americans in the next 10 years. Last year, the initiative, called 110, helped elevate 25,000 people. While that group has placed thousands more this year, and corporate America has racked up promises on hiring more, less than one-fifth of Fortune 500 companies have joined the effort.
The issues are matching the location, the job skill, the type of job that the company needs with the type of people being trained. And that's, there's always a disconnect. Someone needs 10 people in sales in Detroit, and what we just trained with someone in IT in Atlanta. Getting that matching done correctly is one challenge. And two, we need more people participating. And I think the third issue is people are used to hiring the way they hire. A lot of people who are in charge of HR, they have their 10 colleges they recruit from and specific ways that they are used to their systems working. And sometimes it's hard to get them to change as well. So I would say people are more open to it than they were. They're more open to hiring for skills versus degrees, which is important. But it's a slow burn to get there for them.
Charles Phillips now runs a company called Reform. He's one of many Black entrepreneurs who struck out on their own while also staying in touch with big business. He currently serves on the boards of American Express and Viacom. Zanilia Harris has also started her own firm after years at large companies like Merrill Lynch and NASDAQ. Now she helps women across the country build wealth. She says closing the racial income gap for Black women would be transformative and bring real generational change.
The women that I work with, they want to create wealth for themselves so that they are able to live the life that they want. They're able to support their family. They are able to leave something to that next generation. And I'm also hearing how they are still fighting to be seen and heard in organizations that they work in. So this is not just a Black woman thing.
The barriers to creating wealth over generations is something that can't be overstated. John Rogers says it's kept Black Americans back for decades, spanning back to 1619 and the inception of American slavery.
Of course, the lack of wealth that's been created going back in the 1619 Project talked about the challenges we've faced and face in creating wealth in this country through historic discrimination and segregation and the like. It's hard to build businesses when you don't have capital. You know, we don't have multi-generational wealth to help us start businesses. So that's a big problem because minority-owned businesses hire minority people and create wealth in minority communities and create philanthropy in minority communities and political empowerment in minority communities. So that's kind of a big deal, this lack of multi-generational wealth. I think it's something that can't be understated.
But it has been understated for a long time. Issues like this started cropping up more and more after the murder of George Floyd in 2020, and more conversations about race started taking place in corporate America. A handful of U.S. companies gave staff the option to observe Juneteenth in 2020, and the following year it was named a federal holiday, more than 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. This year is the first time the market is closed in observance. Now, Zanelia Harris says there's still more to do for corporate America to embrace the changes truly needed, as racial tensions continue to swell across much of the country.
Even though it's being recognized as a holiday, I don't think that it solves the underlying issue with where we are in America when it comes to race equality. I heard a lot of promises and I was skeptical about whether or not those promises would be fulfilled. And then I think about my daughter and the future and what I am releasing her to. And I'm sad because I never thought that we would be here with race relations. I have a lot of feelings about all of this, and I'm trying to remain positive and hopeful. But as I read the news, I become less and less hopeful that things will change.
And there's new data now to support that concern. A paper circulated by the National Bureau of Economic Research this month says the gap between Black and white wealth is on track to widen even further. Coming up, how Wall Street is looking to close steep gaps in funding for Black-owned businesses and entrepreneurs. That's straight ahead on this Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak, and this is Bloomberg. This is a Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak. Despite fits and starts on corporate efforts to close the racial wealth gap, the difference in prosperity between Black families and white families in America is stark. According to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, a typical Black family had about 12 cents on the dollar when compared with their white counterparts. That gives a white family more than 8 times the wealth of a Black family, and that gap has been unchanged for decades. Equal hiring practices, equal pay, and access to capital for housing are all hurdles in building wealth. But another is access to capital to start a business. According to a study by Accenture, only 29% of loans sought by Black small businesses are approved by large banks, and that figure is twice as high for white small business owners. Ryan Williams is an entrepreneur. He graduated from Harvard, worked at Goldman Sachs and private equity giant Blackstone. Williams started his real estate investment company in 2014 and hit many roadblocks along the way. He had loans turned down by several banks when starting his firm.
It hasn't changed that much, though. You know, it's still really difficult if you're, you know, a minority generally, because there's still a pattern recognition issue. There's still sort of a cookie cutter mold for what, you know, a successful manager, a successful investor looks like to most of our large institutional investor universe. And so I think, you know, on the margins, there's more opportunities and there are more Black entrepreneurs getting funded, Black managers getting funded, women led and owned managers getting funded, but it's still very incremental. And I think that's because people still are fundamentally focused on the kind of blueprint for success looking very homogenous, like frankly, white male as the archetype. And I don't think that's changed.
Is it frustrating?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, I am incredibly privileged in the scheme of, you know, founders and CEOs of real estate investment management platform, especially Black founders and CEOs. I know I'm, you know, at the 1% of the 1% in terms of capital I've been able to raise. And I take a lot of pride in the returns we've been able to deliver to the investors that have entrusted their capital with me. But I get turned down probably 95% of the time.
Ultimately, Ryan Williams was able to start his firm with the help of a Black-owned bank. While the number of Black-owned lenders has declined drastically over the past few decades, they play a huge role in Black communities. This year, Citigroup created a new team in order to work more closely with minority-owned banks and broker-dealers. Harold Butler was tapped at Citigroup to lead that effort after years of working with the U.S. Treasury Department while at the bank. It was a role in which he also helped Citigroup work with Black-owned banks.
Fundamentally, it's all about access to the capital itself. So being able to help banks, for example, create business, to grow their business, and to have the capital to lend is key. But what's different about, say, a Mechanic and Farmers Bank in Durham, North Carolina, in a city, other than the fact that they're a small community-based financial institution and Citi's a large global bank? The difference really is in the power of the neighborhood. That CEO knows his neighborhood, right? He knows those budding entrepreneurs, and he's willing, as a practical matter, to take the risk in those firms of those budding entrepreneurs or Black founders, what have you, and help them to see the possibilities of their dreams.
While Black-owned banks are important, there's still a huge scarcity of funds flowing from the biggest firms to Black entrepreneurs. Cadre, led by Ryan Williams, struck a partnership with BlackRock in order to invest in affordable housing. BlackRock is the largest money manager in the world. Williams said he would like to see more big firms step up to the plate in this way.
I think that there has to be more of these kinds of partnerships between, you know, within the institutional investing ecosystem, where people take the same level of creativity and imagination they take to business problems and apply it to the underrepresentation problem that we're seeing. And that, to me, is encouraging and positive. It's unfortunate that BlackRock's probably the exception, not the norm when you look at all the companies that put out statements and, you know, said we're going to be spending time on and effort and resources on actually trying to help reduce the wealth gap.
And similar to BlackRock, Wall Street is putting top analysts to work on the numbers and how to put more money to work in Black communities. Goldman Sachs last year created a program to get $10 billion worth of capital to firms run by Black women. Megan Hogan heads up diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at the firm.
One of the fastest ways to accelerate change and effectively address the racial wealth gap in the United States is to listen to and invest in Black women. The research at a high level, you know, found that reducing the earnings gap for Black women has the potential to create up to 1.7 million U.S. jobs and increase the annual U.S. GDP by anywhere between $300 and $450 billion. So huge impact there. We're about a year into this since launching in March of 2021. We've made about $1 billion of investments to our seven key pillars. It's part of our long-term strategy. And I would highlight, you know, two recent investments that we made are the MAMI and the Care Academy. MAMI is expected to impact about 12,000 Black women across the country. And Care Academy is expected to impact about 50,000 Black women. So again, we're very focused on quantifying our impact and our commitment.
While Black Americans have found it hard to raise capital and rise in corporate America, Black women have found it particularly hard, and the numbers show it. Black founders represented a mere 1% of venture capital funding in 2020, according to Accenture. And Crunchbase data show that percentage has barely moved. Goldman Sachs calculates that Black female founders account for less than one-third of that ratio. They claim 0.3% of all venture capital funding. And that funding is key for growth when you're talking about a demographic that's often marginalized by corporate America. Zanilia Harris is the founder of Harris & Harris Wealth Management.
I think when Black women decide to go out on their own, it's because of the fact that they feel that there's not opportunity for growth. I had always wanted to be on my own because I felt like owning a business would be another way to grow wealth in my family. And I also wanted to leave a legacy for the children that I would have that they could build upon. But the more and more I read about the history of African-American growing wealth in America, I learned that while there have always been people, African Americans, who wanted to leave a legacy, whether that's building a business, to move up in or get opportunities in corporate America, because at one point we didn't even have the opportunity and we were relegated to only being able to build in our own communities and to service only our own communities.
And that's why leaders like Goldman's Megan Hogan are looking to specific programs to fund startups by Black women. And other firms are doing the same.
1 million Black women, you know, very important to me personally. You know, it was a highly emotional day when we announced it to the firm and had a firm-wide town hall to talk about the potential impact of the program. I was raised by a single mom who worked two full-time jobs to get me through school and through college. And I'm not a huge fan of the Black woman as martyr kind of trope, which is Black women are martyrs, Black women hold us up. I think we need to be flipping things on its head, which is that we're supporting Black women in these roles. We're making sure that they have the best maternal health care. They have better child care programs, you know, for working moms. They're getting the best of the education system and workforce advancement. And through our Black Womenomics research, we just found society failing across a number of issues.
Coming up, how hiring practices at the largest firms can start to move the needle on income and opportunity. That's up next on this Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak. This is Bloomberg. This is a Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak. The difference in prosperity between Black and white families in America remains stark. For Black Americans to build wealth, incomes also need to rise. That means corporate America needs to play a part in hiring more equitably while also promoting Black managers. One area where there's some progress is data on hiring practices. Now, about 90% of the most prominent companies across the country, that means firms with at least 100 workers, are making employment data public. In the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's murder 2 years ago, the percentage of Black managers rose marginally by a median of 0.4 percentage point, while the share of Black employees overall also rose slightly. The disclosures help keep corporate America accountable. For example, it showed that at Walmart, the largest U.S. employer, management promotions for Black Americans actually slipped in the 12 months through January. Yet more workers moved out of hourly jobs into management roles, which means the largest challenges are still as employees move up the corporate ladder. Over at Apple, the largest company by market value, Black representation had declined between 2018 and 2020. The company says it's committed to doing more, but the numbers will tell us if that promise comes true. There appears to be friction at every level. Charles Phillips, who works with leaders across corporate America to help recruit Black workers, says only 72 of Fortune 500 firms have signed on to work with his organization, 110.
It should be more, and we're still in recruiting mode. So I have to call CEOs all the time to recruit and sell them on this. So the initial reaction is, well, I don't think we have the type of jobs that, you know, where we could really hire these folks because we need advanced degrees. In some cases, that's no longer true. You should be hiring for skills and not degrees and rethinking those jobs. So we have to convince them to at least go back and look at the types of jobs. Do they really need a college degree? And then secondly, the same issue of, you know, well, I have processes in place, HR people in place, and they have been filling the jobs pretty well. And so I just leave it to them. The good news is because of the shortage of talent right now, they're starting to reconsider that because they need people. So the best thing that can happen is what we have right now, where it's a tight job market, where people, there's not enough employees. And so that forces CEOs to consider new pools of talent that they really didn't really, you know, pay much attention to before.
Charles Phillips says one key way that corporations can boost their ranks is through hiring from historically Black colleges and universities. A range of banks and investment managers have started doing that. Goldman Sachs, for example, is dedicating $25 million over 5 years to HBCUs, while senior leaders are spending time training students. Goldman's Megan Hogan says it's a shift from a long-standing tradition of hiring from the Ivy Leagues.
When you think about a traditional recruitment model, it is using the alumni base of your current employees to find talent. So, you know, for example, you know, I went to Yale University personally. I know the school well. If I was asked to help with hiring, I would want to go back to my alma mater potentially. That's not a bad thing. You know, I think Yale has great students. But if you're looking at your current employee base and only having them go back to the schools in which they went, you're just fulfilling a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is that you're only going to find potentially the same talent if those schools and institutions are not diverse in and of themselves. And so what I've seen from my colleagues, you know, I used to head diversity recruiting for 4 years before my role as chief diversity officer. And what we really focused on was not just thinking about alumni schools, but doubling down on HBCUs and partnering starting in 2017 with the Congressional Black Caucus to also have some very candid discussions about how we showed up credibly to these HBCUs. Again, it's not enough to write the check and show up on campus once a year. What's the sustainable engagement that's going to make sure that students, faculty, administration, university presidents really know that these companies are interested in long-term impact and sustainability with their students, with their alumni, with the institutions and the curriculum? That is what's truly needed. And so I think I've seen a dramatic difference in terms of that focus over the last 2 years that wasn't necessarily there before.
So Megan Hogan says diversity tends to beget more diversity. John Rogers of Ariel Investments is on the board of companies including Nike and McDonald's. He's seeing some change on corporate boards. And he says adding Black and diverse directors helps set the course for companies not to only hire diverse managers, but also diverse suppliers.
And I see that as we talk to companies that we invest in, I see that on some of the boards. So it is sort of disappointing that we haven't gotten further along. And I think that's why we have to try to find ways that if all progressive companies ask all their suppliers to have minority executives in the leadership roles on the relationships they have, those companies will start to show up with diverse lawyers, diverse accountants, diverse financial services executives, diverse technology, because if their biggest customers demand it, those folks will go out and find diverse people. And I just think can't overemphasize how that question just needs to be addressed systematically. And it's fascinating to me that 40 years ago we did it and we got away from it.
And to address the landscape systematically, John Rogers says we need a wholesale change.
I think you're right. We have to break up the system and think about it in an entirely different way. And it's just unfortunate that people just have gotten so comfortable doing things the way that's always been done, even though it hasn't been working. And so you look in Chicago, again, you look at the 100 largest companies in Chicago, and there's so few minority CEOs in the top 100 companies. I think we have two out of 100. And you look at, again, the major investment banks, the major private equity firms, but major venture capital firms, very few women in leadership roles. And the most important thing here, that's the part of the economy, as I said earlier, where the wealth and jobs are being created. The big banks will have diversity. You know, the big insurance companies had diversity. They, during the civil rights movement, people pushed them to do the right things. But these industries now where all the growth, that's where we're most locked out of. Silicon Valley, again, lots and lots of growth, very little diversity. So I tell my friends in the civil rights movement, you've got to adjust to where the economy's going, not to where the economy was 40 years ago.
Coming up, the role that government plays in expanding opportunities. That's straight ahead on this Bloomberg Equality Special, Advancing Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak, and this is Bloomberg. You're listening to a Bloomberg Equality Special, Achieving Black Equity. I'm Shanali Basak. We've been talking about how progress towards racial equity has been choppy at best. But there's a key reason that changes are still coming, and that's because clients and customers of big banks and corporations are asking for it. Citigroup's Harold Butler and Megan Hogan at Goldman Sachs say part of the bank's efforts are being pushed forward by large corporate clients and even many government clients as well.
They want to be a part of the story on inclusion and being able to support communities, right? And they recognize and appreciate that, you know, the way we do it best is through banks, right? And broker dealers, right? And so if you just think about it, we could say what we want all day long about fintechs and other entities that may be on the rise or have risen to do financial services for people. Banks, Sonali, are trusted. We may catch a lot of darts, sure, right? But we're trusted, right? We're a trusted entities that, you know, people recognize and they know we're regulated. Do we always get it right? No. But are we doing the right thing? Sure. And so our clients say, well, let's look to Citi to help us solve some of these challenges that we have around inclusion, because everybody has them.
And when it comes to the work Goldman Sachs is doing, Megan Hogan says there's a lot of interest from people looking to get involved.
I would say I'm very encouraged and optimistic about the number of people, whether it's clients, students, professionals, senior leaders, heads of state, you know, that are reaching out, you know, to me and my colleagues on raising their hand to volunteer, to be an ally, to advance racial equity, to be thoughtful about actionable steps that they can take, you know, to make sure that there's diversity, equity, and inclusion at their firms, their schools, their societies, you know, as well. The demand has never been greater. I can tell you even, you know, 15 years ago when I started, you know, in some of this work, it was me more pushing into the conversation, where, you know, I had to make myself known, what I wanted to accomplish in the DEI world, especially when it came to the pro bono cases that I worked on. And now it's the complete opposite.
At the end of the day, money flows from the top. Many of the biggest clients of big banks and money managers are central governments, cities, states, and pension systems. So what role does the U.S. government play? The government can and has been looking to boost equality through spending programs and by allocating resources to Black money managers and Black-owned businesses. But the scale is still limited. Charles Phillips has worked with government leaders, including, most recently, the New York City mayor and governor of New York State. He notes that as the largest money managers in the world still lack diversity, the problem is quite circular. Expanding investment could help boost Black communities overall.
Well, the federal government has some very large pension funds, and right now that's largely managed by BlackRock and Vanguard and people like that. They could act and distribute some of that into Black asset managers is one thing they could do. The Small Business Administration is another area that, you know, it's done a good job over the years, but they could accelerate that. I think it was reduced under the prior administration. They're trying to build it back up now, but there's a lot they could do around helping small businesses in general. I think they've done a great job with the CDFIs, and that is kind of the community banks and lower income neighborhoods that do the real lending. And they put another kind of $10 billion behind those, I think, in the last bill, and they're looking to do more. So there are a number of things underway, but they're not as visible and as known because they get a little bit technical.
When Barack Obama became the first Black president in 2009, John Rogers was on the inaugural committee. He says the government is struggling to diversify its resources despite years of efforts.
I think government does a decent job when they have the opportunities to buy directly. You know, they have some legal issues they have to deal with and, you know, court cases against affirmative action that sometimes can make it difficult in certain states and certain cities and the federal government. So I think within the constraints of the legal system, government does a pretty good job. Where they could do better is pushing all the people to do business or get resources from government to do the right things. If you think about it, all the universities and museums and hospitals that got a lot of money from Washington to get through the pandemic, no one's asking those museums, universities, and hospitals about the diversity of their spend and who they're using to manage their endowment or to do their advertising or to do their technology. They're getting a free ride. Same, all the big contractors, you know, the big airlines, Delta and American, or the big defense contractors like General Dynamics and the like, no one's pushing them about all how they spend their money 365 days a year. And that's where government can use its impact and influence to force these institutions to be transparent with how they spend their dollars and hold them accountable on how they spend those dollars. So government can have much more impact if they reach into these institutions that are gathering government resources all the time.
John Rogers says Black leaders in the government have historically helped push some of these efforts along. But Black leaders make up just a small portion of the government. under the tenure of local Black politicians, careers were soaring for Black bankers like Ray McGuire, who rose to become vice chairman at Citigroup before stepping down in recent years, and Bill Lewis, whose career ascended to the highest ranks of investment bank Lazard. He recently left to join private investing giant Apollo Global Management. Lewis recently led a charge among corporate leaders to protect voting rights in Georgia. And when it comes to leaders in the government, John Rogers says Black mayors in particular have spurred companies to invest in Black leaders.
You know, it's interesting to me, you know, it's when I came home from college roughly 40 years ago, Harold Washington got elected mayor of Chicago. You had progressive mayors throughout the country. Maynard Jackson in Atlanta was my personal hero. All those institutions, all those mayors, when they were running their cities, they insisted that all the financial services businesses that did business with their city had to have diverse talent on the relationship with the city. And all of a sudden, if you look at the generation of leaders today, the Jim Reynolds of Root Capital and the Ray McGuires at Citibank, and the you go Bill Lewis, who'd been a Lazard for a long time, and you know, you get all these guys got their careers going roughly 40 years ago when these progressive mayors forced the investment banks to have diverse teams on the relationship with their cities. And I could go through at least a dozen of the leaders. Sometimes they're still a big company. Sometimes they started their own firms, but they got started because important mayors demanded these financial institutions look like America. And we got away from that. There are so many priorities that political leaders lead with, and that's one that they haven't been as a consistent with as it needs to be.
Citigroup's Harold Butler also says that the government, both through federal and state laws, has had a history of prohibiting the advancement of Black society. Some of that was through Jim Crow, and another big part of that was through redlining. When the U.S. created the Housing Act in the 1930s, Black neighborhoods were deemed more risky to invest in, and banks therefore stepped back from lending to them in a big way. That created the need for more Black-owned banks to step up and funnel capital into communities. And what made matters worse is that Black neighborhoods also face death, loss, and damage through violence. Harold Butler cited the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, where a district known as Black Wall Street was burned down. Hundreds died, and many thousands were driven out of their homes.
And so when you think about, you know, how Black communities went from the signing the ratification of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1865 and what did not occur after that, right? And events like Jim Crow that became a byproduct of the anger that society, that white America had against people of color, right? Because of the fact that labor wasn't free anymore, right? And so if you just start there, right, and you look at what occurred when a Black community dared to kind of buck the proverbial trend and create wealth and build a sense of community where they weren't allowed to participate elsewhere, which is Tulsa, right? What happened? They burned it down, right? And, you know, since 1865, right, and Blacks being shut out of the economy and being shut out of just being able to survive and prosper and generate wealth, this is where we are today. And this is why the plight, if you will, why Black banks are so incredibly important, right? Because they were really created and came into existence to be the conduit in the vehicle to create wealth. Because if you have systematically a system that's geared towards, you know, whether it be laws, the Housing Act, and things like that, the redlining effect that I know you're very familiar, you all have done great content on redlining in communities. And I know a lot of people are familiar with that, but when you put all that into a bucket, right, it's the combination of exploitation and deliberately not including people of color. So banks have played a key role and continue to play a key role in being able to help entrepreneurs, help people get home loans and things like that. But even still, they themselves have been locked out of the capital markets for a long time.
When you think about the impacts of redlining today, it's still true that Black applicants have lower rates of approval for mortgages at all major lenders. A Bloomberg analysis found the disparity is greatest at Wells Fargo, where half of Black applicants are rejected. That was even the case during the mortgage refinancing boom in 2020, when white homeowners saved an estimated $3.8 billion. And in response to our reporting on Wells Fargo's treatment of Black applicants, the bank said it treats all potential borrowers the same. It also said it's committed to closing the minority home ownership gap. The U.S. Department of Justice is still trying to combat redlining, which is now an illegal practice. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been eyeing banking deserts across the country, areas in which people are unable to get loans. Zanelia Harris explains the ripple effect that comes from being shut out of the housing market.
So when I look at all of the laws and things that have been passed in America and how when they get passed, they were supposed to be an opportunity for all, but end up you seeing carve-outs. Well, yeah, it's for you. It's supposed to be for all, but not for you. And so when I look at, you know, this fight for Black banks to succeed, because you know there aren't that many Black banks that are left in America. So when I look at the struggles that they had to form and then to be a resource to their communities and then strive to then be cut off, so therefore, you know, African Americans couldn't get access to capital in order to purchase property. And, you know, property is the foundation of a lot of things. So if you have property, then you can leverage the property to, well, you have to, if you wanted to build, if you wanted to start a business, because whenever you go for a business loan, they're going to ask you for, you need an asset for them to collateralize in order for you to get that loan. So if you are not able to purchase a property, then, and it still exists. I mean, like, if you're going for a loan, a business loan, they ask you what your assets are because they need to attach, they need to have some way to secure that if you default on the loan, that they're going to get their money back, right? So if you don't have any assets, you're not going to get a loan. And for most people, their largest asset is their home.
The U.S. government is also taking some actions to get more capital to Black communities. For example, Harold Butler says the Treasury Department is starting to advance its work with some of the Black-owned banks that he works with.
I'll just start by saying, give the U.S. Treasury, some kudos here. Because in the first time in over 233 plus years, whatever the amount of years is in Treasury's existence, they've never worked with a small Black financial institution, right? So today there are two banks, Industrial Bank in Washington, D.C. and Unity Bank of Texas, that are engaged in Treasury portfolio business. Now, as a subcontractor, that's okay. Treasury still had to approve it, right? But it's an important first step, because even for the government, right, it has to be about inclusion, and I'm not suggesting it's easy for the government, because if you look at the scale and volume of the way they do business with people like you and I, the citizens, and they do business with other governments, and they do business intra-government, you know, it's their inherent risk, right? It involves capital to be able to have people on the ready to do things and make investments in what the government would like you to do. And so it's not easy.
Critics say progress at the government level is still moving in the wrong direction. But still, John Rogers says changes emerging in corporate America can continue to move the needle.
You know, we have these progressive political leaders now in Washington. Maxine Waters chairs the House Financial Services Committee, and Joyce Beatty, chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Really great leaders like here in town, Congressman Robin Kelly. If we lose the House, it's going to be much more difficult to bring the kind of change that we hope for, because I know this Congress is committed to getting supporting minority business and resources to help minority businesses be successful. So I worry that's going to be it could go the wrong direction next year, depending on the election. So I'm working hard to hope that doesn't happen. The positive side, though, is that, again, our Civic Committee We hope that that can be a role model for how other cities can work with their local business organizations to do the right thing. And I know there's lots of talks going around the country. The Business Roundtable and others are talking more about working with minority-owned companies. So there is a buzz out there that's hopeful. So we had a few green shoots. And I think finally we have to point out the success stories. You know, here in Chicago, companies like Exelon and McDonald's have long histories. University of Chicago has a great history of working with minority businesses and creating minority wealth. We need to celebrate those success stories and hold them up as role models the way that other anchor institutions can do similar things in their hometowns.
As John Rogers said, there are green shoots. But just as many companies have made progress on some equality goals, others are showing that there are setbacks too. And there's no promise of progress moving faster either. It's why keeping companies and the government accountable is so important. For entrepreneur and private equity alum Ryan Williams, it's about the follow through, and the change will simply take time.
It felt like this wasn't just, you know, lip service. I think the unfortunate reality is that the numbers in terms of, you know, capital being committed to diverse managers, in terms of, you know, representation from a hiring perspective, they don't actually show the kind of change that we would you know, have believed was in the making a couple of years ago. And that's frustrating. And the inequality in representation has been centuries in the making. And, you know, it's been crazy to think that within a year or 2 years, there'd be parity or there'd be a level playing field. So I think you have to take that into account, the long-term nature of the issues that we've seen when assessing, you know, the timeline for its solution. But what I will say is that despite the fact that there hasn't been the kind of follow-through on a lot of fronts that you might have hoped, there have been some really promising and impactful steps forward that are left. And so my hope is that, again, as we reflect on these last couple of years, we recognize that there's been far too many of us who have made statements and put out, you know, commitments, but haven't followed through with attempts or action to substantiate those commitments. And again, it's better in many ways to try and to, you know, take the time to figure out how to bring to life what you said, even if it's not initially or immediately impactful, than it is to, you know, take the conventional path and or the risk path and wait, you know, to be pressured or pushed to action. So hopefully these discussions can catalyze just one person to reassess, you know, the difference between what they said and what they're doing and drive change in meaningful ways.
And we'll leave it there with those thoughts from Ryan Williams. Thanks for listening to this Bloomberg Equality Special, focusing on achieving Black equity. You can get more news and stories like this online at Bloomberg.com/equality. Also, check out season 4 of The Paycheck, our podcast focused on equality. Find that on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. I'm Shanali Basak, and this is Bloomberg.